There's been a long-running battle against diabetes. And of course, you know, there are continuing to be new discoveries trying to find ways to help people who have diabetes get off that injected insulin for good. And there's new research out of the University of Alberta, a first-in-humans clinical trial reporting some early signs that pancreatic cells grown from stem cells can be safely implanted and in some cases begin to produce insulin. So these are amazing new milestones and groundbreaking discoveries that are still going on. But the battle against diabetes has been going on for a long time. Of course, we remember primarily the story of Frederick Banting, right? He's the scientist now famous for discovering insulin. Diabetes was a death sentence prior to this. It's a story of success and achievement and all the things that are great about science and achievement. But there was more to the story back in the day, according to Kirsten Hall, who's an author and honorary fellow in the School of Philosophy, Religion, and History of Science out of the University of Leeds. And he's joining us here this morning. Kirsten Hall, good to have you here.
Good morning, Daryl. Thanks very much for having me on the show. Sorry, you've got me on to talk about insulin. You've got me thinking now, what's the difference between a novelty song and a fun song? So I'm just going to have to do a quick mental gear shift there. Let's get back to insulin.
When we're done with the insulin story, we can you'll have had a moment or two to stew on it, and we'll come back to you on it, okay?
Okay.
You referred to the discovery of insulin as a story of monstrous egos and toxic rivalries. Oh my goodness, this sounds like a soap opera.
Oh, it is. The story of insulin. Look, the story of insulin, right? Just think Game of Thrones, but enacted in lab coats and with pipettes instead of chainmail and poison daggers, less nudity, actually.
Probably.
You've mentioned Fred Banting.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So 1923, right? Fred Banting gets a phone call one morning in October from an old friend, a very excited old friend. The old friend says, "Have you seen the morning newspapers?" And Banting says, "No." So his friend tells him, "You've just won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of insulin." Now, just think about that for a minute, right? Banting has been awarded the most prestigious award in science.
How
would you feel, right? That's got to be the telephone call that every scientist secretly dreams of getting. What's Banting's reaction? He is furious. Oh. He is utterly livid. What does he do? He tells his friend to go to hell. He slams down the telephone receiver, checks the morning paper. Yes, it's true. Jumps in his car, drives across Toronto in a rage.
Why is he angry? Is he angry because somebody else broke the news to him or because he won the prize? Because that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, does it? No, the reason he's angry, and I just love this, this is great. The reason he's angry is because the Nobel had not just been awarded to him, it had also been awarded to his boss, Professor John McLeod, Professor of Physiology at the University of Toronto. And as far as Banting was concerned, McLeod had no right whatsoever to have any share in the credit for the discovery of insulin. By God, he was going to get in his car, drive across Toronto and have it out with McLeod. And a lot of people thought, you know, it was going to basically turn into fists flying because Banting, he had a little bit of a temper on him.
See, that's funny to me because these days is a lot of that history gets whitewashed or just forgotten because the most important thing is the discovery of insulin.
Yeah, of course it is.
And you applaud and you laud Frederick Banting for doing it. But, man, toxic egos, huh?
I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, you got to feel, you know, Banting wasn't the only person who was furious about that award. You got to feel a little bit sorry for a German doctor, Georg Zeltzer, because when he heard the news about Banting's award, he looked on with utter dismay because as far as Zeltzer was concerned, he'd already discovered insulin back in 1908. 13 years before Banting, he'd been isolating, he'd patented it, and he'd actually been injecting it into patients with some degree of success. So you can imagine how poor old Zeltzer feels. He just looks on, thinks, "What? Hang on a minute, I discovered that." So, you know, you see, the plot just thickens. But I've got to say, you know, as far as I'm concerned, regardless of who discovered insulin, I'm glad they did because I'm a direct beneficiary of it. I've just written my book about it, Insulin, the Crooked Timber. Well, the inspiration to actually sit down and write that book was my own shock diagnosis with type 1 diabetes just over 10 years ago.
What's the name of the book again?
Timber? So it's called Insulin, the Crooked Timber, a history from thick brown muck to Wall Street gold.
The Crooked Timber, what does that mean?
Oh, it's from an old quote by German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who once said, "From the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing can ever be made." And I think those little examples I've given you there of the acrimony between Banting and MacLeod and Zeltzer just show you just how crooked the path to insulin has been.
Fascinating. Did MacLeod have a case? Did he have, like, Banting thought he had no right to have any play in
the... Yeah.
Did he have a case?
Look, I'll be fair to MacLeod. Look, had it not been for MacLeod, Banting would have just probably remained a struggling GP in provincial Ontario, right? Because, you know, Banting had come back from the First World War as a decorated war hero, courage under fire, right? But he gets back to Ontario, he realises, look, you might have medals on your chest, but that's no guarantee of an easy life on Civvy Street. And his career began to go downhill. Wanted to set up private medical practice, didn't quite work out, found himself cooking his meals over a Bunsen burner, too skint to afford a trip to the cinema. And then he goes to MacLeod with this idea of finding the mysterious anti-diabetic hormone produced by the pancreas. And MacLeod gave him the benefit of the doubt, gave him lab space in which to do it. So, you know, to be fair to MacLeod, MacLeod's the guy who gave him his first peg up on the ladder.
Okay.
I think...
Not as intensely involved in the research itself, then?
Well, he was directing them because, I mean, there's a mythology has grown up around Banting, and we've got to mention his colleague, Charles Best, you know, because it was a duo. It was a partnership.
We think about Banting and Best. Yeah, we don't think about Banting and MacLeod.
No, exactly. Well, you know, I just wonder sometimes whether it's their names have a nice alliteration. Maybe. Banting and Best, you know, it just trips off the tongue, doesn't it, right? The mythology is that the summer of 1921, you know, Banting and Best, these two young, inexperienced researchers, struggle against all the odds, come up with this miraculous discovery, scorned by their boss, MacLeod, who's gone off to a fishing trip in Europe for the summer. And, you know, I can't talk to you about insulin, not mention the late, great Canadian historian Michael Bliss, who wrote a fantastic book on this story in the early 80s, 82, The Discovery of Insulin, does what it says on the tin. And Bliss had gone back to the original lab notebooks of Banting and Best and shown that a lot of those early experiments, they were inconsistent, they were poorly controlled. And MacLeod pointed all this out to them at the time. You know, he kind of shepherded them through it all. So, you know, you can't come down too hard on MacLeod.
I suppose, but there was obviously, there wasn't just one ego involved because you've written about how MacLeod sort of, like, he fought back too. So Banting may have been fighting MacLeod, but MacLeod also fought back and tried to grab some of that praise and try and keep some of that credit for himself.
Sure. And the other person we've really, because this is, you know, radio in Edmonton, the other person we've got to mention is James Collip, who is from the University of Alberta at Edmonton. Because the thing is, this week, been a lot of people celebrating the fact that 100 years ago on the 11th of January, the first human patient, 14-year-old Leonard Thompson, who was brought into Toronto General Hospital at death's door, was injected with some extract made by Banting and Best. But the fact that's easily overlooked is that very first injection wasn't a clinical success. The poor kid came out in a toxic reaction due to impurities in the mixture, right?
Oh, man.
2 weeks later, January 23rd, he's injected again, and this time it is a success, right? There's no toxic reaction. What had changed in those 2 weeks? Well, what had changed was that second batch of extract hadn't been made by Banting and Best. It had been made by James Collip. He'd cracked how you could use alcohol to clean up that thick brown muck and get rid of those impurities. So it's really Collip's extract that saves Leonard Thompson. So we've got to get Collip mentioned in there as well. But then Banting began to suspect that not only is MacLeod out to steal his thunder, but Collip is as well. So the whole thing just becomes, as I say, a viper's nest, a festering stew.
So
why it makes a great tale to tell. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I get excited about this because now I'm trying to figure, we keep having TV shows about lawyers and police officers and investigators.
Yeah.
Why don't we have them about the machinations and the egos and the toxicity in research?
Let's do it. Well, in actual fact, Darryl, there is, let's have a think, end of the 80s, there was a TV movie dramatization of this story. It was based on Michael Bliss's book. It's called Glory Enough for All. I have tried to track it down. The only place I can find it is YouTube. The picture quality is a bit ropey, but it's still worth a watch. It's an engaging drama. Might be time for a digitally mastered re-release of that, if anybody out there is listening.
Thank you for that. And thank you for giving me a new term, because I'm going to talk about things as being a little bit ropey. Love it. Okay, before I let you go, I set you off and I sidetracked you a little bit on your topic. We're just playing around and having some fun here as well this morning, as dealing with some other issues. A novelty song or fun song, what is the difference, do you think, between what would qualify as a novelty song and what is just a fun song?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to have to go away and really mull over that one.
Well, you don't have to research it. We're not going to get all angry at each other over this research.
I think a fun song is something you associate with a particular time of your life. So musically, it may not be up to much, but the fact is, it's the memories it brings back. And this kind of brings me nicely to the fact, for me, that would probably be any song in the summer of 1989, because the summer of 1989, I spent in Canada. I was a student at the time. I lived in Toronto for the summer. I worked selling ice creams off a pushcart in downtown Toronto. It was probably the best job I've ever had. Great memories, great people. So thank you, Canada, for that one.
Thank you. And thanks for telling that story. I love the passion and the joy with which you tell this story.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show, Darryl.
You betcha. Take care.
All right,
have a great day.
Have a good weekend now. Take care now.
You
see
you. Bye-bye.